Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM. You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you. And welcome, 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 good dear listeners. As we obviously take a look at this end of May, obviously the... An announcement coming a day after public holiday. I was just told by an acquaintance, which I also just made specifically about, you know, in terms of looking at always how appointments and discussions are held a day after public holiday. Look, I'm sorry, guys, but in many scenarios, the rest of us also have particular deadlines and jobs and particular, you know, responsibilities and obligations to meet. But in terms of the fuel price announcement that just happened, as you heard, specifically this is for the month of June that this announcement happens. If you've never seen the particular, the modus operandi of the Ministry of Industries, Mines and Energy, which also includes their particular representative, the minister himself, that being Minister Amutse, highlighting obviously at the end of a month for the new month, they make this particular announcement. So we'll have to see for the end of June what the fate or the fortunes of the Namibian economy holds, specifically with regards to the fuel pressures coming through from the block plus block equals unblock equation that Donald Trump and his particular, you know, strategists have deployed with regards to the Strait of Hormuz, with only Iran basically maintaining the particular stranglehold it has over the world's most important maritime trade facility in the global economy. But we are technically, actually, just before Helmut actually joins us now, it's a coincidence. It's actually a pure coincidence. And Helmut technically will also agree with this after having to listen to all the audios that I shared with him, specifically regarding the UN Sustainable Development Dialogue. The series dialogue. Do you know what's the worst part of that name? Yeah. It was only for that day that engagement took place, Helmut.
And they called it a series.
They called it a series because apparently the series is that it was happening.
It's in reference to, it's happening
all over the world at the same time with the various UN missions within member countries across the world.
All UN member states.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this series formed part of Namibia has to talk part of this discussion. How does an economy like Namibia become resilient? But before we actually also reach the main part of our conversation, we just have to let you know, dear listeners, that about 4:15, that's at 4:15, we'll be crossing over to an in-depth discussion with a on-air host, specifically from the Road Fund Administration. We'll be having an interesting discussion coming through at that particular time frame. For those listeners that have seen our social media posters on our socials, primarily it is slated in terms of in terms of the time frame, we'll actually be starting at 4:15. Now, since we still have a few minutes to go, Helmut, I actually want to ask you about the coincidence between the announcement that the minister made now a little bit earlier, yeah, and technically us talking about this. We also have to disclose to the listeners, we actually didn't plan for this discussion to take place today, even though we did plan yesterday for today.
Yeah.
We didn't plan for the content to technically coincide with a fuel announcement from the Minister of Mines and Energy. So, I'm technically just asking for your backup, Helmut, just to sort of like confirm or affirm said particular indication.
Look, they do fall in a, they basically do fall in a sort of like the same direction. They go in the same direction. If you look at the, what's being provided, how to put this, the Minister of Mines, gave that announcement basically for the fuel prices of the month of June all around the country. Pardon me, but I like how he started by pointing out, looking at Zambia, Eswatini, and I believe Botswana in terms of comparing prices so that we can appreciate just how much our government is doing to cushion the, you know, the price.
Mm.
Yeah. And now, if you look at the reason why the minister was giving that announcement is the reason why the UN were, the UN was having all these discussions all around the world, because it all roads lead to Rome, except Rome in this case is the US Israel Iran conflict, because that's where you are seeing all this cascading a series of events that are impacting global markets, which are then biting and burning holes in our pockets, as in you and me that are literally thousands of kilometers away. And so the minister's announcement for the prices of prices all around the country for the month of June and the UN Sustainable Development Dialogue all tie into the
same conflict.
Yeah. You're looking at the global market fallout of that very same conflict.
Mm.
Yeah, and how to sort of like prepare for it, or how what to understand about it in terms of how it's going to impact an ordinary person when it comes to a day-to-day living.
There is a little bit of an interesting thing here also, Helmut.
Yeah.
This is obviously how we've looked at everything from across the African continent, across the various conversations so far from the start of this year. I'm pulling in from the when the UN Conference of Trade and Development representatives were here to present that report that can help Namibia sort of like diversify from its extractive industries.
Yeah.
And in all of that, Helmut, this conversation points squarely to what we should have achieved prior to this year to be resilient to, I'm going to use a word that's out of place, an unnecessary shock that we are not involved in.
Yeah.
Well, okay. The Ukraine conflict is also an unnecessary shock.
We
are also not involved in. We didn't start it. We're not the one arguing with Ukraine. We're not bordering onto Ukraine. But this thing impacts us.
I think this points to some of the, like everything else, global market connectivity has a lot of convenience when it comes to having, take, for example, accessing products that you don't have in your country or resources that you don't have in your country to make your economy run. And that's a positive part of global market connectivity. But one of the negatives, as we have observed, is that once a conflict starts in one region of the world, the whole global market is, they are going to feel the domino effect of that conflict. And we saw that during the COVID-19 pandemic. We saw that during the early days and to this day of the Russia-Ukraine war. And now, the escalation of the Iran-US-Israel conflict has just been, has basically made things worse, but it's not the only conflict, albeit it carries much more momentum in terms of influencing market prices, and that's because of the Strait of Hormuz. So the strategic location here is what is causing all this chaos that we're seeing, unfortunately for us. And that's the Strait of Hormuz also made a significant a significant part of the agenda of the UN Sustainable Development Dialogues. And that's because we're talking about a portion of water that is about 30 something kilometers wide, and but carries a global impact in terms of market influence implications. This is a passage way that that sees 13% of global fertilizer, 38% of global oil, and 19% of global liquefied gas, and about petroleum gas of, you know, at 29%. So all these things, it's obviously going to, you know, it's going to cause a serious disruption in the global market. And that those disruptions will have a domino effect that will lead up with you and me paying $15 to go home.
Well, and plus the fuel price. But yeah. Before we continue, Helmut, we quickly have to put a bookmark in our discussion right there. Dear listeners, we'll quickly be taking a short break and we'll be coming back right after the break, heading into the interview that I made reference to just a little bit earlier. That will be the interview with the Road Fund Administration, and we'll be talking to our on-air guest, that being Mr. Nehemia from the Road Fund Administration. On that note, we'll be back right after this. You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
And coming back to listeners there from the short break, and as well as also heading into our conversation for the next 30 minutes, that's now from now 4:15 till 4:45. Specifically, we're joined on air by Mr. Nehemia Kapofi, who is the Senior Engineer for Program Management, Policy and Advice from the Road Fund Administration. And we'll be actually talking about the introduction to the RFA, its mandate, and its footprint. Mr. Nehemia, thank you for taking the time to join us here on air, here on Eagle FM.
Thank you, Dwight. Good afternoon. Good afternoon to the listeners.
100%, 100%. Mr. Nehemia, if we obviously start off since this is a start of the series of discussions that the Road Fund Administration wishes to share with our listeners and the broader public, could you help us with the role of the RFA in Namibia?
Thanks, Dwight. The Road Fund Administration, it's a public enterprise incorporated in Namibia. It was established by an act which we call the Road Fund Administration Act 18 of 1999. Basically, the road fund was set up to manage the road user charging system and raise revenue through this system in order to secure and allocate sufficient funding for road expenditure, road development, as well as road construction, in a nutshell. Mm. And it was based on the premise that it will recover the full costs from the road users as per the definition of the RFA Act.
100%, 100%. And then if we also look at the next question in terms of the footprint, how is the RFA's footprint in the country?
Thanks, Dwight. Before I indicate the RFA's footprint, basically what the road user charging system entails, we are required to determine the amount of funding and the manner of funding for projects and programs. On top of that, we are required to determine the road user charges that are to be levied so as to impose these charges on the road users to ensure future sustainability of the Namibian road network. In terms of our footprint, basically when I do come to the road user charges that we collect, you will appreciate how we are set up countrywide. We have our main head office located here in Windhoek, formerly Feld Street, now Seretsekama Street, not too far from Marua Mall in the Ausspanplatz area. Most of our road user charges, specifically the cross-border charges as well as the mass distance charges, are collected through our offices located at our entry points, which are our borders, as well as inland offices. Specifically being in Windhoek itself, as well as others strategically located in the country.
Uh,
100%, 100% there, Mr. Nehemiah. And then if we, as we look at the next particular talking point, which you mentioned, the road user charging system, but before we, since you've already highlighted that part, there's also the aspect in terms of why road funding is important. Can you share some of the details there with us?
Thanks again. Thanks again, Dwight. We obviously understand that in terms of the broader economic development of our country, and then we certainly know that through our national development plans over the years, starting with NDP 1 in 1990, up until recently NDP 5, and last year, which was launched by Her Excellency, the President, Her Excellency, Madam Netumbo Nandi-Daitwa, NDP 6.
Mm.
Now, in terms of the broader vision, Namibia aspiring to be an industrialized nation by the year 2030, that's part of our Blueprint Vision 2030, which will be carried on by NDP 6 now, for us to achieve that ambition of being a logistics hub in Southern Africa, serving markets beyond Namibia through what we call our key corridor routes.
Mm.
We have the Trans-Zambezi running from Walvis Bay through Zambia to the DRC and also serving the latter part of Malawi. We have the Trans-Kunene. Trans-Kunene is what we probably also call our north-south corridor through Angola into Oshikango, also part of it serving southern Angola through the Menongwe. And then we have our famous Trans-Kalahari Highway. This is running from Walvis Bay through the border post at Beite Post, Mamuno, further through Gauteng to link up with the port at Maputo in Mozambique.
Mm.
So from a strategic point of view, that is the importance of why road funding is important. And we know that roads are a key catalyst towards national development. And then just for interest sake, you will appreciate, including the listeners, that over 90% of our passenger movement is carried by road, and about 80% of our freight, that's the movement of goods into and out of the country, is carried by road. So roads are a significant infrastructure asset to our country. And then definitely without roads, including other African states, we cannot trade amongst ourselves. We cannot integrate as per the vision set out by the founding fathers and encapsulated in the African Agenda 2063. 100%.
And then, Mr. Nehemiah, you did mention the road user charging system a little bit earlier. But in terms of just how does it actually work, how does this road user charging system work in terms of that the RFA obviously will be making use of?
Thanks again, Dwight. Well, the road user charging system, in brief, it's a system comprising of a number of road user charges through which instruments the Road Fund Administration collects revenue for the maintenance and rehabilitation of the national road network. Now, the system comprises of a number of key charges, which I will allude to in a short while. But basically, the system, it's meant to determine the rates of these charges, as well as the amounts and the manner in which these collections shall be made, so that we impose on them or we request the collection thereof from the road users to meet the funding requirements of our national road network. Now, this system or these instruments comprises of our key revenue source, which we derive from the fuel levy, which accounts to about 60% of our total revenue, including now what we call your annual vehicle license registration fees. Basically, when you go to a NATIS center to renew your annual vehicle license disc on your vehicle. And then we have another charge, which is particularly imposed on on foreign vehicles entering the country, what we call the cross-border charges at our border post. And then the mass distance charge, this is levied on vehicles with a mass exceeding 3,500 kilometers, both foreign registered as well as locally registered vehicles.
Mm.
And to a lesser extent, abnormal load fees and road carrier permits. Your typical example I can give is your Intercape buses, which do the long haul in the country as well as out of the country.
Yep. And then
also these charges then constitute what we call the road user charging system.
Yeah, because it's obviously this umbrella charge categories that would be applied across the country.
Correct, right.
Yeah. So, Mr. Nehemiah, if we also look at the RFA's role in Namibia's economic growth and safety, what can the listener see from this particular role that RFA plays in these two particular examples?
Thanks again, Dwight. I did indicate the significance of a sustainable, well-developed and well-maintained national road network.
Mm.
On top of that, also a well-developed urban road network. These are the roads that are managed by our local authorities, that is the municipalities, as well as town council, feeding onto the national road network.
Mm.
Now, from a broader perspective, the role of RFA, as per its founding legislation, is to secure and allocate sufficient funding towards the roads subsector. Now, having said that, obviously our mandate is one of importance to our economy, alluding to the fact that without roads, we as a nation cannot grow, we cannot develop, and we cannot trade with our regional as well as international partners.
Mm.
Being a very, very responsible corporate citizen, the RFA takes its mandate very, very seriously. And if you historically just look at our country, Namibia, with its vast, sparsely distributed population. In fact, we have one of the highest GDP per capita in terms of road service to the nation. So road linkages plays a very, very critical and important role in our country. In fact, it speaks to one of the key pillars under NDP 6, which is to maximize the provision of road transport infrastructure along with other modes of transport.
And that obviously also helps us get into the next particular question, which also will lead us into our conclusion, Mr. Nehemiah, in terms of what should the public expect specifically in terms of all this discussion that we've had so far?
Thanks again, Dwight. Now, obviously, the mandate of the RFA is very strategic to our country. We have seen in instances where if we don't provide adequate or sustainable funding towards our national road network, we risk the collapse of this network. Specifically where we know that Namibia over the past few years, I would say 7 to 8 years or so, has been lauded on the continent as having one of the best quality maintained road network, even surpassing bigger economies like South Africa, Morocco on the continent. And globally, we are ranked in the order of 22nd, 23rd globally, competing with advanced economies such as Singapore, Hong Kong, and some European countries. Now, it is very important for the public to understand that for the future sustenance of our road infrastructure, an asset which is valued at over 220 billion Namibian dollars.
Mm.
We need to provide adequate funding for its maintenance and rehabilitation. So it is for the public to understand that when the RFA specifically requests through its portfolio minister, and hopefully with the support of the our portfolio minister being the Minister of Finance,
mm.
and the support from our Minister of Industrialization, Mines and Energy, for us to understand and be appreciative of the fact that the provision of road infrastructure comes at a cost. And this cost can only be recovered from the road users. So as a road user and a Namibian citizen, we need to appreciate that when we are required to pay our road user charges, I'm speaking now of your annual vehicle license registration fees, the fuel levy that we normally request for adjustment year on year, speaking to the needs of the network out there, of which we are already funding below optimal.
Mm.
We are able to only fund about 50 to 52% of our needs. Hence, our indulgence when we request for rough adjustments on an annual basis. But we do understand that in the long term, the fuel levy, which is our biggest revenue source, is being eroded and is not sustainable in the long term. So we plead of the public to understand, support the RFA in its effort to secure sufficient funding for our road network. Currently, in the past 2 years, I'm sure Dwight and you yourselves and the listeners can see the effects of the rains and floods of 2025 and recently of 2026 as well, yeah. And the numerous potholes on our national road network, as well as in the city of Windhoek. So without adequate funding, we're not able to fully suppress these interventions. So we call on the public for their support in whatever we do. And obviously, the public can rest assured that the Namibian dollar invested in road infrastructure has the added benefit of reducing vehicle operating cost, has the added benefit of reducing vehicle travel time cost, and any other savings that will accrue to the road user in the medium to long term.
Mm.
For instance, if you take the road between Okahandja and Karadut, obviously the travel time savings and the improvement in road safety.
Mm.
Albeit that there's other road networks, road sections on the network, which we still need to address. Specifically, we know the Usakos Arande Swakop is a key one. We know the road between, Oshivelo, towards, via Omuthia to Oshakati. It needs some intervention, as well as the road between, Grootfontein, Murani to Rundu, and some sections of road from Kongola to Katima.
Mm.
But given the needs out there and the funding that we're able to collect, we are slowly getting there to address some of these critical road maintenance and rehabilitation needs on our national road network, as well as within our urban centers, which are our municipalities and town councils.
100%. Mr. Nehemia, before we end off on our discussion here, whereby the listeners can have also had an opportunity of understanding specifically the role that RFA plays, is there anything else that you still wanted to add before we end our talk? And in terms of just ending the discussion for this Friday, before we get to episode 2, which will be later on in June, in terms of which will be another session whereby the RFA will also share some more valuable information with us.
Thank you, Dwight, and certainly on behalf of the board of the RFA, its management, as well as staff. I am really grateful for this opportunity for the RFA in broader terms to explain its mandate to the listeners as well as the public and road users. Obviously, as we engage in future conversation, there are challenges that we are facing as an organization, but because of our integrated strategic business plan, basically our strat plan for the next 4 years, having commenced in 2024 up to 2029, we have put in place specific strategies to overcome some of our challenges. Key one being the insufficient funding. The other one obviously being the exploring of alternative revenue funding sources. We need to shift towards a more sustainable distance-based road user charge, alternative road construction material. So we have sort of indicated some of our strategic interventions linked to specific key performance areas indicators that we need to overcome. So on that basis, we look forward to engaging the public further and provide them a better understanding and appreciation of the role and mandate of the RFA in support of a sustainable and future development of our road network. Obviously, they say no man is an island. We appreciate the roles of sector institutions, specifically the roads authority, the local authorities, as well as our other institutions that we engage with on a day-to-day basis. Also, the National Road Safety Council in promoting a safe and operational sector in as far as reducing road accidents on our network is concerned. With that, I thank you very much and wish the listeners and the nation at large a pleasant Friday as well as a blessed weekend.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Nehemiah, in terms of just also engaging with us about on this particular Friday with the extra knowledge regarding the role that RFA plays in the Namibian economy. Thank you once again for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Dwight. Thank you.
And on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end for that conversation that we've had here, brought to you by the Road Fund Administration in the conversation we had with Mr. Nehemiah Kapofi, who is the senior engineer from the RFA for the program, for program management, policy and advice. On that note, we head into a short break and we come back heading into the rest of the Home Run programming here on your number one talk radio station. This is Eagle FM. On that note, we'll be back.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Welcome back. We continue from here with the Standard Home Run. And today is Friday and payday. So watch out for the, you know, like, what's that, I believe, International Financial Advice. Watch out for that junction where your salary meets the weekend. because that's how you go through the weekend and then come out the following, you know, week and find out that you didn't pay your rent, you didn't buy food, you don't have transport money to go to and from work, so now you are just broke. So that junction where your salary meets the weekend is today. So just make sure you pay your rent before you, you know, you join the homeless statistics come next week. But because, you know, especially seeing that the price of everything is just seems to be skyrocketing again, thanks to the conflict in the Middle East. And it doesn't seem to have any trustworthy ending in sight, because well, we are all, you know, if you, you know, like we pointed out just before that brief interview, that both the UN Sustainable Development, you know, development dialogue, and the you know, and today's oil prices for the month of, you know, fuel prices for the month of June updates, they all have one thing in common. They all heavily you know they are all centered on the negative domino effect, or you know, ripple effect that's coming out of the war in the Middle East. And now I don't like to use the word war in the Middle East, because that is very general, because much of, for the most part, we could be talking about, well, Yemen, last time I checked.
Syria,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that's how I like to just, you know, to point out the trio, because Syria has been just mired in armed conflicts with the US and Israel supporting one side. And the, you know, Bashar al-Assad at the time was more, you know, on the side of the Russians. So, you see again that, you know, there's a conflict that's going on in the Middle East, and you have, both members of the UN Security Council backing one side over the other instead of just, playing their role as UN Member Security Council, you know, to bring about the diplomatic solution to a conflict. But, for the most part, these guys are just engaged via proxy. And that's pretty much the same story with Ukraine. You have, again, Russia is a UN member state, and the NATO member, you know, NATO is made up of, you know, of how many UN Security Council members are in NATO? You have France, the UK, and the US. All three of them. So again, from the look of things,
and NATO includes the G7 economies minus China and Russia.
Now, you are looking at guys that are trusted with a diplomatic solution to armed conflicts, and they are terrible at it.
They are actually behind.
Yeah. They are behind much of the global
destabilization of at least one North African. Syria is Middle East.
Yeah.
And Iraq obviously was a spillover.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Now, when you expand the, you know, when you expand the discussion to NATO countries, and France is on the is on that list, that brings up, you know, that brings up all the, you know, pretty much all the chaos going on in West Africa, especially the parts of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. So again, you see a UN Security Council, a UN Security Council member, you know, a country popping up wherever there's a conflict.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's just why, I mean, that's why I'm, you know, I want to point out that, you know, for me, the conflict between Iran, Iran and US and US slash Israel, you know, the one that's having all these domino effects of, you know, in the global market, which is now shooting the cost of living through the roof. Even for us that are very far, literally, economically, and politically away from it. And one thing that you see there is that there doesn't seem to be a solution, you know, in sight that people can just look at and see that it's legitimate. That means, you know, chances are very high come next month, the Minister of Mines will have to, if things are not settled, we'll have to listen to another update again on whether or not we're going to be buying, you know, fuel at the same price, or is going to be increased depending on how, you know, on how the global market is going to be impacted by the further blockade And we should have seen this from day one. I mean, the math that was done from day one is block, block equals unblock. Now you see the problem.
Yeah. And then I showed you, did I show you earlier about the, what media, specifically international relations or foreign policy media have highlighted, even though there is an actual magazine, an online editorial platform by the name of Foreign Policy, FP is its name.
Hmm.
FT is Financial Times, most. Is that the recent negotiations apparently to try and force the other Middle Eastern countries that were blocked by Iran,
mm-hmm.
you know, the other Arab nations,
yeah.
That they are being forced to accept the Abraham Accords of 2020. Now,
oh boy,
this is where the block, block, unblock becomes
worse,
even worse.
Yeah.
Apparently, the diplomats from these other, which are most of them kingdoms like Kuwait, UAE, Oman, and Qatar,
yeah.
and Saudi Arabia. These four, five guys are technically kingdoms. They're yeah. sultanates, if you wish to use a more, you know, colloquial term in terms of identification.
Yeah.
And they are also the heart, basically, of the OPEC organization.
Yeah.
They are also the countries since 1953 who technically do not recognize Israel. Now, apparently, in the negotiation realm of things, Donald Trump and his representatives, government representatives, his administration representatives, yeah. have been trying to convince many of these Arab League, I call it the Arab League, but let me rather say these Arab Kingdom nations, to accept the existence of Israel, which is against the whole philosophy and the fiber of the whole foreign policy, national policy, and even the national identity of much of these kingdoms
yeah.
in terms of the reason why they exist. So now, in order to supposedly achieve a peace deal with Iran, you are trying to tell your allies, accept this document that I've got here. And your allies in the Middle East are the same guys who are part of the whole of the global south outside of Europe
yeah.
that don't recognize the existence of Israel.
You know, the whole Abraham Accord is an interesting discussion to bring up as a condition for the peace deal between Israel and Iran. I'm just going to keep calling it Israel
yeah, because,
and Iran.
Because
I mean, in the early days of this conflict, it was, you know, suspicions were made that, you know what, Trump is not in, you know, Trump is in the passenger seat here. Netanyahu is in the pilot seat. And now, now from the look of things.
It sounds like a taxi driver and his cat, but the taxi driver is not the one driving the war.
No,
it's
not.
Technically the passenger being made to drive
to
the
drive,
war.
Yeah. Look, the thing is, the reason why I actually believe with that point of view is that that interview that we referenced from Bloomberg with Anthony Blinken, where he pointed out that the idea of going to war with both Lebanon and Iran was pitched by the Israelis to both Obama and Obama and Biden. Mm-hmm. They just said no. Now, in other words, if Obama should have said a yes to the, to that proposal, the bombardment going on right now, being done by Israel on Lebanon should have happened during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. So Obama said no. And the war between, like all the high prices of fuel and everything that we are paying now, that, you know, that should have happened if Biden said yes to go into war with Iran. Biden said no. And fast forward to 2026.
Yeah.
Now you are looking at Trump comes into office and he just go to war with the two countries that his predecessors both said no to going to war with. That's because it had no U.S. interest based. It was all it was all Israeli based. Now, from that interview, I think, Anthony Blinken's interview just clarified the suspicion that people had that, the White House doesn't have control over when this war ends. Tel Aviv does. And, now, with that in mind, I want you to go, you know, I want us to go back to the, you know, to the whole Abraham Accord. When this came up in 2020, who was in office at the time?
Homeboy.
Exactly. So,
block, unblock, homeboy.
Now,
I sent you now a document about the Abraham Accords, Helmut, just in terms of criticism from a think tank.
You get to the criticism. Let me walk you through the countries that have signed the Abraham Accord. Now, this is going back to, you know, this is, from the 2020, that's Trump's previous administration. You have, if you just go on the U.S., U.S. state web, U.S., Department of State, Department of State website, you'll find there's one there for, you find a list of countries that are basically signatory to, I'm not sure if there are any amendments that have been made, but, Saudi Arabia is not on this list. The first, you have a declaration, and then you have the Israel-Bahrain agreement on the Abraham Accord, and you have the Israel-Morocco, and then you have Israel, believe it or not, Sudan.
But they didn't sign.
Sudan?
Yeah, Sudan, it says here in 2025, this, this Middle Eastern Institute. That's why I shared that document quickly with you. Sudan, the Middle Eastern Institute, the Middle East Institute, the MEI, they say here, everything went through with Israel and Bahrain, Israel and Morocco. UAE, and then Israel and Morocco, because Israel and Morocco was the last one in 2020, and then the next guy was supposed to be Sudan, because Sudan said, yeah, we are there, and then they met in, you know, in 2023. However, they, because they agreed in principle.
Yeah.
They agreed, yeah, let's normalize relations.
Yeah.
And then Sudan went into the civil war. So technically, Sudan doesn't have a government that can step forward and acknowledge the agreement of 2023.
They did sign. It's just that they don't have a government in place right now to be, you know, to be told, you know what, well, you signed to this agreement. Therefore, you know, is it still in force or not?
Yeah.
Because they don't have a, oh boy.
Because the RSF wants to be the next government and the,
and now you have the RSF and the UAE are embroiled in all this. So, oh, you know what? This is welcome to.
it just looks weird, because if you have to look at this, the pretext of our discussion, the UN Sustainable Development Dialogue series, a war doesn't speak anything.
No.
To sustainability. It doesn't even speak anything to
actually,
dialogue.
It's counter.
It doesn't even speak anything to dialogue, to the whole word, because the word dialogue technically means there's diplomacy, there is mutual respect somehow, there's some aspect of you know, communication taking place.
Yeah.
Nothing based upon, in a dialogue you are highlighting, we must have war in order to have good relations.
Open the link I sent you and go to Morocco. Yeah. Then just scroll all the way to the end. And just read for me the names of the signatories.
I know, things get ridiculous that way.
Morocco, straight to the signatures.
Oh, way at the end.
Way at the end, yeah.
Okay, no, it just highlights the download documents.
Oh.
Yeah. We are encouraged. What does it say? Yeah, we are encouraged by ongoing efforts to consolidate and expand such friendly relations based on shared interest and a shared commitment to a better future. That's all I've got.
Is that on the
on the document itself, like that?
Just you see that last line at the bottom there. Just find Morocco.
Oh, Israel, Morocco.
Yeah, Israel, Morocco.
Okay.
Yeah, then you just scroll all the way to the end. I thought told you. Your real estate guy.
The real estate guy.
Turns out homeboy has been doing underground diplomacy for
it. No, but he has been most involved, Helmut. Because here he was a senior advisor to the US, to Donald Trump back in 2020.
Dwight. You can make me the advisor to the president, but the question is, do I know a thing about diplomacy?
But he is Mus. Hamoud, he is Mus. He is Mus, the son-in-law Mus.
Oh, boy. So he's...
Because if you even look at...
Look, you don't gain qualification by sexuality. You gain qualifications by going to school.
Look, because this is the Bahrain Israel document, ne?
Yeah.
The signatures. There you see the three heads of state.
Yeah.
Witnessed by Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Signed on the one side by Netanyahu. Signed on the other side by the foreign minister for Bahrain, Minister Abdul Latif Al Zaini. But the moment you go to Israel, Morocco, it's literally Chief of Government Said Saad Dine El Othmani from the Kingdom of Morocco. For the US, Jared Kushner, senior advisor to the president. And for the state of Israel, it's Meir Ben Shabbat, national security advisor and head of the National Security Council. So everybody sent. Oh, and the director general of the foreign ministry of foreign affairs also for Israel. So everybody sent basically representatives to sign and witness.
Now, the reason why I took you to this document, so just stay on that document and go under highlight. That would be the third paragraph.
For Israel-Morocco.
Yeah, Israel-Morocco, under highlight.
Highlighting the proclamation of the U.S. on recognizing the sovereignty of the Kingdom of Morocco over Western Sahara. Oh, my
God. Yeah.
So this brings the United
States... It's about mutual benefit.
No. This brings... The United States in direct conflict with us, the EU.
Exactly.
The whole of AU.
Yep.
Because the whole of AU acknowledges the independence movement for Western Sahara.
Now, Morocco knows that. And now, the mutual benefit out of these agreements, if it still stands like this, especially in as it relates to Morocco, is Morocco gets to recognize Israel. And the U.S. gets to recognize, and plus Israel gets to recognize Western Sahara. Win-win. Except not for the African Union. This is going to be a diplomatic blipstorm. A very big one.
This is not a blipstorm, Ahmed. This is a pitfall of epic proportions on foreign policy.
Yeah.
So...
Which now makes the whole recognition of Somaliland last year makes a lot of sense.
By who?
Israel.
And Somaliland is not even a UN recognized country. It's not even a country because Somalia claims ownership of
sovereignty.
Somalia.
So now
and there's an American base in Somalia.
Look, after going through all these agreements, one thing I learned is that, if all these agreements are based, if the new ones are based on the same principle, then it's about benefits.
Mm.
Yeah. So I'm willing to sign up to the recognition of Israel, but what am I getting out of it? Now, from the look of things out of this agreement, Morocco, that these agreements clearly point out in very simple languages, the U.S. has a recognition of what? Of Western Sahara. And then the whole discussion, the whole Abraham Accord is, has to do with the recognition of Israel. Even though the whole, the name is Abraham Accord. And that one is well summarized in the agreements, in the agreements. Is it with,
it's named because of Abrahamic,
religions.
Religions, which is Christianity, Judaism
and Islam.
And because all of them come out of the same Middle Eastern neighborhood.
And they all acknowledge Abraham.
I am realizing that politicians are the most problematic people.
Now, with all these hodgepodge of topics that have to be unwound.
No, Helmut, it's not hodgepodge. It's literally...
Dwight, this is poiki right here.
I know it's poiki, yeah. But it's not our poiki. It's a poiki.
Look, it just became us. it just became ours.
And the worst part is Namibia. Under President Geingob.
Yeah.
At the AU of 2023 or 2022.
Yeah.
Namibia pledged.
Yeah.
For the independence of Western Sahara. The US and Israel immediately
responded
to Morocco's appeal by saying, okay, Morocco said, yeah, sure, no, fine. You know what? You guys are the world's two most aggressive militaries in the world.
Yeah.
How about you recognize my ownership over West Israel?
Then there is these guys.
And then we can be friends, Israel.
Yeah.
It's not a problem. And then Israel is like, sure. How about it, my bruises? You know, nothing lost, nothing gained. Because technically, this is an agreement of nothing lost, nothing gained. But who's losing?
You recognize AU. Mine, I recognize yours.
Who's losing? AU.
A point of correction then. Not who is losing, who has lost?
AU.
I'm saying who has lost because...
In 2020, Altlar. We can't even talk about this. Because this agreement was signed before 2022, 2023. When the AU was talking about Western Sahara's independence, left, right...
Yeah.
The Altlar, Helmut. It's done. It's done.
Yeah. It is done because...
It's done.
It is done.
This document is signed. It's done. Helmut,
we have a commercial break.
We're back right after this, guys.
Yeah, welcome to the world of geopolitics. That's just a thread one of just how complicated this whole thing is on the other side of the break.
You know, there's something about opening a Tafel Lager that brings people together.
Yeah, and once people come together, the voices follow.
Ideas get shared. Laughs get louder.
New perspectives come up where you least expect them.
Because when people use their voice, conversations start.
And those conversations, they can refresh a moment and even shape what happens next.
So, grab a Tafel Lager and start the conversation. Tafel Lager. Now we're talking. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you.
Welcome back, and it's just 5 o'clock on the dot. And if you just tuned in, this is a Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. And as always, we're here until the hour of six, just pointing out some of the, you know, just how painful the realities of the Israel-Iran war right now. Because we're all looking forward to the solution of, maybe there is going to be some kind of, comeback in terms of the cost of living, prices and all that. But the solution doesn't seem to be anywhere inside. And every country that's negotiating, it's negotiating with its own interest in mind, not, about global market and all that. Now, if you look at the differences in both what Israel wants to achieve and what Iran wants to achieve, the Iranian government has been a big supporter of the Palestinian resistance. It is a resistance movement. A Palestinian resistance of the Israeli occupation, and Lebanon with Hezbollah, pretty much the same thing. So the Palestinian resistance and the Lebanon resistance, they are on the same side with the Iranians, except the issue you have here is that the peace deal, Iran wants the peace deal to extend to both Israel and Lebanon, Palestine and Lebanon, especially southern Lebanon, which is basically right now being carved up and being added to the occupation. And this is now creating, it's drawing a scary map of when is this whole thing going to come to an end, so that people can see if there are going to be any, any reduction in prices of pretty much everything that is skyrocketing the cost of living the world over. So you have one side with its proposal, in this case Iran, and you have Israel and the US with their own proposal, which are all leaning heavily in in the direction of Israel as the author of all this, as the author of all these terms and conditions. what, you know, one thing that points out is, like, the mutual ground for these two is, would be a very interesting one to see. And that's just the mutual agreement of the leadership. The mutual agreement of the people. Take for example, even if the leaders themselves, like the entire Middle East, or, you know, this is Southwest Asia, Middle East, I mean, it's Middle East if you are in the US. We are in Southern Africa. It's not the Middle East for us. It's South Asia, basically. Now, if you look at the, I don't want to say North Africa because, well, that's, you know, that's not part of Africa. Now, let's call it South Asia because we are not in the West to call it Middle East. Now, here's the thing. Look at it this way. As one of, society level, conundrum of how this whole Abraham Accord, even if it were to be signed by, you know, Iran and every government that's involved for them to work together, they will have to come up with an entire re-education of all their societies so that they can live together in harmony. What do I mean by that? Now, for those of us that have been following all the, you know, all the chaos coming out of that region, especially with regards to war, one thing that you can see there is, even if all the Abraham Accords, as they're being proposed right now, are signed by all the governments involved, including Iran, these governments will have to go on a re-education spree. And that will mean, you know, just start from the politics alone. How will the Lebanese government, for example, have to explain to the southern Lebanese that are losing their land right now that this is a good, idea to sign to? And,
it's not the Lebanese government who's the issue.
Yeah.
It's because in the Lebanese political landscape,
yeah,
the Lebanese politicians have to accept the Hezbollah politicians.
Now, that's another problem.
Because it's Hezbollah shooting the rockets, not the Lebanese army, not the Lebanese government.
Mm-hmm.
An armed political entity in Lebanon is the one shooting rockets at Israel.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, let's say all these countries now signed up. I'm just looking at the, just taking the leadership out of the equation. Just citizens of all these countries that are called on to sign up to the, to the Abraham Accords. They're just the ordinary people. All these governments will have to spend a whole lot of money and re-education for them to, to basically bring their people to live together in harmony. Did you see the, is it the Louis Theroux documentary that he filmed? That he filmed in Israel.
Mm.
Yeah. What were those people saying? They said a lot of what you'd classify as right-wing politics. Now.
Louis Theroux.
Yeah.
What did you say, Helmut?
Louis Theroux. Is it Theroux?
It's a French name, but the name is technically Louis.
Yeah.
It's the English.
Oh, it's Louis. Oh, yeah. Louis the 13th. Yeah, the T and S is silent if it's at the French language.
But then it's not even the, it's te, because French, for the TH of names, they say te.
Theroux.
Remember the footballer, the French footballer, Thierry Henry?
Yeah.
His first name was written TH.
Yeah.
No one said Thierry.
Thierry. That would be nice. Yeah.
I think there was a whole bunch of people probably went like, but it's Thierry. So
Thierry.
It's Louis Theroux.
Yeah. Now, the documentary that guy made just revealed a lot about an ordinary Israeli's point of view.
And he made that last year. I remember that documentary because he had a lot of backlash.
Now, there was one guy in that documentary saying, well, I have to take your house because if I don't, someone else will come and take it.
I thought you were going to mention the auntie he interviewed.
That auntie is the West.
The auntie who's in charge of the NGO.
Yeah.
Who is driving
the whole point of view that is very far, far, far right.
Yeah. The settler colonialization of Palestinian properties.
Now, with point of views on a societal level like that.
Guys, an NGO that promotes colonialism.
Just go and take that house. It was promised to you by God about, 3,000 years ago. Even though it was built about 40 years ago.
And no one has proof of the...
The guy that promised it to you 3,000 years ago didn't leave a title deed. Now, the problem, the problem there is now it becomes a society's issue. Now you're talking about bringing together those people with that point of view. And I don't 100% blame them.
Mm.
Yeah, because for someone to think like that, they must have been taught to think like that. No one just wake up with that point of, with that point of view of, you know what, I have to take your house because if I don't, someone else will come and take it. It takes a lot of energy and money to brainwash someone to that level. So, even if all these governments came together and signed to the Abraham Accords, these communities will take them a very long time to come together and realize that they are all human beings and that they can live equally together. Now, before you start saying, you know what, it's just a Jewish thing. Jews are all, no, they're not. Because again, they're Jews in Namibia. They're Jews in Iran. They don't have that whole mentality. So this is beginning to seem like, it's an Israeli thing, not a Jewish thing. There's a big difference. Now, so you have the Abraham Accord being brought to the table. And the question is, what are the chances of, what are the chances that all the countries like the Saudis, for example, are going to sign up to these agreements? And of course, if we can look at it on the same level in terms of what's in it for me point of view, in terms of the Israel-Morocco agreement, from the look of things, it's all about, I will sign to it, but what's in it for me? If there is something in it for them, chances are very high they're going to sign it. If there is nothing in it for them, chances are very high this signing is going to drag on a little while. And the longer it drags, the more it disrupts global shipping through that strait, the more the cost of living is going to rise, the more we are going to experience economic pain.
Yep.
Unfortunately.
It is the unfortunate part, Amut, because... If we look at this particular conversation in terms of what really impacts sustainable development across the world, three countries deciding to have a slugfest, three countries who are impacting you in Namibia's life, and specifically unfortunately, your government doesn't have a response to this kind of scale of global economic, it's not even a ripple effect. It's like a tsunami.
Yeah, definitely a tsunami for economic size.
Yeah, it's technically a tsunami. So what am I saying? So what I'm saying is, Namibia just today indicated specifically that for June, the boat won't rock that much.
Yeah.
Fuel prices will stay the same. But Minister Amutse noted that between 28 February, when the conflict began, up until now, the government has paid close to $1 billion, basically absorbing any economic tsunami waves.
So, in other words, it would have been worse.
It would have been worse. And he explained this in that address.
Yeah.
That if the government said, okay, leave it to the fuel retailers to charge whatever price they want, many of our lives, unfortunately, dear listeners, would have been in ruins. Just because of block plus block equals unblock. Block, block equals unblock.
decided to throw rockets at Iran. And Iran then transferred, like in a kung fu movie, when you transfer, you know, energy from one position to the next. Iran just transferred all that energy was through rockets to oil refinery infrastructure in the Middle East around them, to water desalination plants in the Middle East around them, to military bases and airline infrastructure in the Middle East around them. And it is chaos. Because the last rockets that were fired were even last week.
Yeah.
Like the last, you know, from the Friday, I think, over the weekend.
I think let's just call them the recent, because those guys can fire at any time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But literally it was like this past weekend. So the discussion even, and this is what even finds me, what I also find a little bit weird is because the Abraham Accords apparently set down some normalization, as which is the word they use here.
Yeah.
Normalization of activity. Or normalization of relations between Israel and some of the Arab nations around it. Or the, can we rather say the Muslim, the hostile Muslim nations around them. But before we continue, we'll quickly take a short break, guys.
Okay, my turn. Hold on. Just let me finish my story. As I was saying, I was...
My man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm.
Just give it more eyes. Anyways, long story short.
Oh, aye. When you're talking, it's a short story long.
Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Welcome back. Quarter past the hour of 5. You still listening to Home Run with Hampton and Dwight on Eagle FM. So where were you?
Yeah, so the normalization discussion obviously is one based upon relations, you know, international relations, that particular realm. Now, we face two primary issues here. The Western Sahara discussion, which is now obviously that Morocco has now backing to technically own Western Sahara in name and not in spirit. Because the AU is still against that idea.
It has a different point of view, yeah.
But there's literally a legal document now that technically throws all of that into the AU's particular position against Western Sahara claiming, you know, ownership over Morocco.
Sovereignty.
Claiming ownership over Western Sahara and Western Sahara's goal to become sovereign. And then you've got to look at the discussion, obviously, of what's happening in Sudan. Because Sudan was also, like I highlighted, you know, they did sign something, guys. So, you know, like what Helmut said, something was signed, but it's a declaration that was signed. It wasn't like the agreements of the Abraham Accords that we've seen with the other agreements.
Yeah, like Morocco.
Like Morocco, like Bahrain, like the UAE one, that there are three high-level representatives that actually
signed up to this thing.
It was just a declaration. There were two proxies there. One guy from the Sudanese government and another guy from the Israeli government. There was no one witnessing from the American government. We probably don't know. There might be CIA there. Would have been some person there. But today, looking back since 2023 even, and you ask the question in hindsight of after said particular agreements were signed, I understand now why the story, the article that was it foreign policy had earlier, yesterday or actually Wednesday, regarding the Abraham Accords, is that specifically it seems that the US is now trying to go back to the countries that actually signed this thing. And secondly, that it seems like some of these countries that signed onto it, except for Morocco and Sudan, obviously, is that some of them obviously don't like this notion specifically of being in Iran's crosshairs
and for hosting American Army bases, and specifically, unfortunately, having signed the Abraham Accords. I say unfortunately because one of the things here is that it cites here one other particular news international news outlet says Pakistan was cornered by Trump's Abraham Accords push, but Pakistan itself also went and did a very weird thing. They sent 8,000 troops to Saudi Arabia to defend Saudi Arabia from Iran after Iran also shot into Saudi Arabia's territory, you know, with the conflict since 28 February. Saudi Arabia had been one of the victims of Iran's retaliation, retaliatory strikes that had taken place since 28 February. And when you look at these particular scenarios, now it seems like in full strength that the Abraham Accords is now being sort of like used as a shield by the Americans, by Donald Trump specifically, so that everyone agrees to this thing. But the first question we have to ask is, who shot at who first? You know, when you go and think like a police investigator, go watch real crime documentaries, Helmut. Especially, what's that police officer's name? The guy who was appointed just because he was the only guy that had a degree. Literally, Joe Kender. He's like a veteran police detective in the US.
Yeah.
And he has his own documentary series. But you should see his face, Helmut. This is a man that has seen the worst of humans. Now, it's one of the...
I can only imagine being in that line of work where you are exposed on a daily basis to what, to just how violent human beings can be towards each other.
But for you, the police officer,
yeah,
to investigate this on a daily basis, because yeah, the whole, all of Joe Kender's shows, his episodes,
yeah,
of his TV series, is about the real cases he had to respond to.
Yeah.
Real cases, real victims, real atrocities. Yeah. And the particular scenario that we obviously see here in the real world scenario is, if you had to go and think like the process, for example, like Joe Kender outlined there as a police detective, who are the first obvious suspects to a crime? Let's say if it's a murder scene, a husband is found.
Those that are close to the deceased.
Who are either the family or who are either the loved ones.
So close to the deceased or close to the victim? Those are the number one.
Okay, let's use victim. Yeah, let's. If the victim was a husband, you investigate. You start with the wife.
Yeah.
If the victim,
they're not accusing you. No.
They just start the process of elimination in terms of
just to eliminate everyone. Yeah. Just to eliminate.
If it was the wife, then they immediately start with the husband.
Yeah.
If it was a girlfriend, immediately with the boyfriend. If it was a boyfriend, immediately with the girlfriend, and then they branch out into brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, children,
coworkers.
Like that. Yeah. And then they follow all potential leads and obviously all lines of inquiry.
Yeah.
That's how the police operate, guys. Now, and I'm sometimes so shocked when you hear of Namibians who say, and the police just rocked up.
They're eliminating all the possible.
No, Helmut. What were we taught by our parents? What did you do?
Oh, yeah.
Guilty by association. Where were you? Why did the police talk to you, Dwight? What did you do? I don't know. I was just there. Where were you?
It's just standard procedure.
But if the police talk to you,
yeah,
the police have something on you. Let's also be honest, Helmut. If the police come to you, the police have something on you.
Yeah.
Or they are following, like we said, a line of inquiry.
But especially in take for example in a family, and I'm not a police officer. This is coming from a bunch of documentaries. They start from close relatives. It's like the people closest to the victim, and which actually makes sense because it will not make sense if if I'm found dead today and then they go and start investigating people in Kietmas. Because, well, the first question the people in Kietmas would be, who's Helmut? we don't even know that guy. So it makes sense for them to start with the people that the victim had a close associations with. Because, it's either you know something that could help us solve the case, or you're the one that did it.
So I referenced the online magazine Foreign Policy, right? Now this is, it seems like it's an opinion, because they labeled this particular thing an expert's point of view on a current event.
Yeah.
So this expert identified as Matthew Duss, or Matthew Duss, one of the two. He states here specifically that Trump had announced back in 2020 the dawn of a new Middle East, saying that these agreements will serve as the foundation for comprehensive peace across the entire region. At that stage, you know, even myself, a Dwight of 2020 would have said, huh, Trump, you know what? You're actually making sense.
Fast forward
2026. And you would definitely say, hell no.
Absolutely.
Not in a million years. Not even with a stick would you come close to that, to say, even try to saying yes to that, but to that particular, summary, because, even though it was meant for comprehensive peace across the region.
Yeah.
And this is obviously what this guy says, something which nobody thought was possible, certainly not in this day and age. But if we go back to what started on 28 February, so the Abraham Accords has nothing to do with Iran. Straightforward, Helmut.
Mm-hmm.
The Abraham Accords have nothing to do with Iran.
And yet they are part of the peace deal.
Yeah. They are part of the peace deal today. But the Abraham Accords has nothing in foundation to do.
Okay, now, here's the thing though. Asking yourself one question though. Iran, even if you take, for example, you take the Abraham Accord, I don't think they, you know, that's going to sit well with the Iranian government. Like, that will be a waste of time, ink and paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is why it's, you know, they just decided to throw in a towel. You know, that will be the equivalent of Iran drafting a nuclear, a nuclear arsenal building agreement and then submitting it to the Israel and the US. They will not sign that thing.
Yeah.
And the same goes for Iran, basically, when it comes to this, when it comes to this Abraham Accord. One thing you also have to understand is that, Iran, after 1979, and the relationship between, the relationship between South Africa and Iran flipped on its head in 1979 after the overthrow of, of the Shah.
That's where I wanted to get to.
Yeah. And, that flip in relationship is that, after the overthrow of the Shah, the new government that took over, the previous government, aka the Shah, supported the South Africa's apartheid regime. Yeah. They were close homies. And now the thing is, after the overthrow, the whole relationship between South Africa flipped on its head. So the new government that came in stopped supporting the apartheid South African regime, started supporting ANC, and they saw that through all the way to independence.
And ANC was I think ANC is still registered as a terror organization by the American government.
To this day?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Remember, I showed you that.
Yeah, I remember. I think Mandela was, until 2015.
And that Mandela was still, up until a certain time, Mandela was still recognized as or was still listed as a terror target or as a terrorist by the American government. So fundamentally, there's a lot of things wrong in this conversation. It's one of the reasons also why I cited as well that if you had to look, even if you look back at, for example, Namibia's role in the foreign policy realm specifically that America has played in.
Yeah.
So America had, what's the guy's name? Before Nixon, the guy that was shot, Kennedy?
JFK.
Kennedy, was pro South Africa occupying Namibia.
Yeah.
Kennedy.
Yeah.
It's Nixon that realized, let's try and make as less enemies as possible, specifically in Africa. Now, sometimes Nixon did, he, because I see similarities in like the realm of what historians have told us about Nixon's behavior as a person and as a national leader of the US and what we see now in terms of Trump.
Nixon will say one thing one month.
And do the other.
And then do the opposite the next month. But in some cases, Nixon also brought in good policies and good foreign policy discussions. Because for Nixon to say, hey, you know what, South Africa, you know, this thing in Africa, this you colonizing another country across the Orange River, it just doesn't sit nice.
Wasn't this about the, you know, at the height of the Vietnam War?
It was, because the Vietnam War was starting to become, the American public was starting to become aware of
what's going on.
And the American public never knew that they were at war with Vietnam. But they saw their loved ones, their family members, their children.
You should look up the name of that district.
Coming home with PTSD, missing limbs, heavily injured.
They were like, what the heck is going on here?
I thought you were being sent somewhere in Asia to go and teach English. Why are you coming back with injuries? And then what the American public did not know is that for the American government to go and declare war on another country, they needed congressional approval. They didn't have congressional approval. And yet the American public was asking questions about why are American soldiers coming back injured?
Or in body bags.
What are we doing in Vietnam? Who is in Vietnam? And when the American media decided to cover Vietnam, but before we continue, guys, we've got an ad break.
You know, there's something about opening a Tafel Lager that brings people together.
Yeah, and once people come together, the voices follow.
Ideas get shared, laughs get louder.
New perspectives come up where you least expect them.
Because when people use their voice, conversations start.
And those conversations, they can refresh a moment and even shape what happens next.
So, grab a Tafel Lager and start the conversation. Tafel Lager, now we're talking. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back. So, Vietnam.
So, Vietnam, yeah. And now, in military strategy, what happened, what the Americans did with Vietnam, is that the Americans deployed what they call mission creep. Mission creep is, you say 1 month, hey, I'm sending advisors to Vietnam. And then the American government is like, okay, so this is the extra budget that you need this for. Yeah, that's what. But Hanekamp, the extra advisors is like 1,000 U.S. Marines with some hardware. The American government doesn't know why. You are just being told, no, it's just, you know, to go and advise.
Now, imagine as a soldier being dropped in the middle of Vietnam after being told there's no war, only to find out you have to go through tunnels.
No, but that's not what the soldiers heard.
So the soldiers were told the reality of what is going on the ground.
Yeah. And the American public was told one thing. That's why you need to be afraid, Helmut.
Didn't they come back from their deployments to sort of like...
That was the first part that I explained before the break.
Yeah.
So when you look at this particular thing, that's why in the broader scheme of narrative, discourse, and the information that's out there, specifically on the internet, you have to be careful around whatever you see on the internet, and specifically on certain media platforms.
Yeah.
Because the armies of the countries involved literally have, what do they call that? Counter argument? Not counterintelligence, the other one.
It can't be counterterrorism.
No, it's literally misinformation. They literally deploy misinformation.
Yeah.
This happens greatly with the Israeli army. The Israeli media speaks only to an Israeli army spokesperson, and then only that person is cited in official media. But if you go talk to the Al Jazeera Arabic or the Al Jazeera Palestine guy on the ground who had to dodge bullets like he was literally, what's that guy's name from rugby? Like he was literally Brian Abana because he had to be quicker than the bullet. Plus, he had to sidestep so quickly to evade the next bullet in order for him just to get to safety. That particular account is ignored.
Yeah.
And then the UN is blocked from sending in or responding through
independent investigators.
Independent investigators, humanitarian aid. And as well as also the particular protection of foreign media who are trying to actually cover the particular conflict. Now, when you see these anomalies happening, Hamid, and I'm not going to mention any names here specifically now on this lovely Friday, but there's a fellow media personality, and I also won't say where he mentions, but recently was sent to Russia, and they got like training, Hamid, in literally how to literally generate propaganda. Yeah, that's it. War propaganda. Yeah, that's the word. War
propaganda.
War propaganda. To literally generate war propaganda. And I asked him, what were the results of that? Can he give an example of one of the training sessions? He said, literally, if your country's in war with another country.
Yeah.
Nah. If a civilian on the ground is saying 40 people were shot and died from a particular military action. Nah. You ignore that civilian's voice in the realm of media and you talk to the official spokesperson of your army, of your country's army. And then that official spokesperson has to confirm to you whether or not what that civilian who saw 40 people in their village or in their town lose their lives, they have to confirm what that person is saying. Now, in the realm of science, specifically with science, science works on one of the most basic human mechanisms that we still practice till today. Science and history. And science relies on history a lot. In science, first-hand observation is the most treasured evidence, an account of an event happening. How did you and I know about Tunguska? Remember the Tunguska event?
Tunguska event in 1908, yeah.
Yeah. They say if no one in Russia at that time, if the Tunguska event happened 200 years earlier,
yeah,
we would not have heard of Tunguska. No one would have been able to explain the Tunguska event even.
Yeah.
But because Tunguska happened in a time when there was a few farmers and the Soviet army, no, not Soviet, the Imperial Russian army had like observers or something like that.
Yeah.
And they could observe the event and go to the event, to the crash site.
Yeah.
But it wasn't actually a crash, it was just a...
It's like mid-air explosion.
Yeah, it was a mid-air explosion that had vibrations that flattened the trees.
Broke windows, I think, of 200 kilometers in radius.
Yeah. It's the same thing also with what was the volcano that British soldiers witnessed somewhere in Indonesia, or was it Thailand or Indonesia or Thailand or Philippines?
The Millennium Eruption was in the side of North Korea.
No. This literally happened in like the 1800s, this eruption of this volcano. No, it was in Tonga, either Tonga or in somewhere in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
The British soldiers who witnessed the eruption said it was so loud, it ruptured their eardrums. They were like something like 5 or 8 kilometers away on boat from the island.
8 kilometers?
Yeah. Helmut, if you had to see the last eruption that took place there in the Pacific Islands region, that one of 2020 or 2021, that other eruption, that eruption was so big, it spewed dust into the atmosphere that was falling in, that was impacting sun up and sundown conditions in Europe and in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, such particular events, which shows a corroboration of various voices, various witnesses, that's what science wants, that's what science craves for, is you must have first-hand events, first-hand witness accounts, and then the witnesses also wrote it down, they recorded it, and then the scientists can pick it up, and then go and analyze the particular crash site 100 years later on in human history. Now, the realm of war, which is a realm of politics, which is a realm of humanity, is an ugly thing, Helmut. Do you know why I say it's ugly?
In the First World War, the German army propaganda machine was saying, yeah, we were winning. We were winning. They were telling the German army's information unit was telling the German media at the time in the First World War period, they were winning. There were strategic battles being won. And then suddenly there are retreats from your army. Your army
and
is
like, how, what do you mean we're winning?
Your army is retreating and just retreating and losing space. And the things are happening here. Casualties there. Surrendering of the army on these particular events and days. And then the German public started asking questions there in the First World War period. But you said you guys were winning. How come you are now busy losing? Which is also a dimension of morale. Public morale,
yeah.
Public fatigue about warfare. This is where Sun Tzu's particular knowledge comes in. The longer a war, the more fatigue your civilians start experiencing. Because your civilians will start asking questions of, our best food is going to the army. Why is the army fighting?
Yeah, because it's expensive to maintain an army.
Yes. Wherever an army is based, the prices are at premium. Now, who's paying the army? For the army to pay those prices at market rates, which will be overly inflated. It's the taxpayer paying the army so that the army can have money to buy supplies from the economy. Same fatigue dilemma. The last one is ultimately the discussion in terms of what happened in France with the French Revolution. Because the French state was in perpetual wars. The French public at the time, under the last French king, went and said, we are sick and tired of the wars. You are defending a cousin over there. You are responding to your in-laws from Spain over here.
Turned it into a family event.
Because it was family events.
Yeah.
You are fighting another cousin over there. First, you're defending a cousin from another cousin. And now you go and invade another cousin of yours. What is going on?
What does that have to do with us?
And it's not just that question. Yeah. The question was, but our best agriculture is going to the army. Our best food, our best supplies, our best product.
It's going to you fighting your cousin.
Basically. You should read up, Helmut, just as something noteworthy to read upon there. You should read up about the economics of kings in medieval Europe. Medieval Europe up to the French king of the last French king before the revolution, where the economics was so severe. If a king in Europe made a loan, and the loan was just so that his army can have food and not for his people to have food. You should read how weird the economics is. It's literally kindergarten economics.
Definitely.
But it was scary stuff.
Look, the thing is, the people that are going to repay back that loan are the people on the ground.
Yeah.
So they have every right to be mad.
Yeah.
And when it comes to, at this point, it's safe to say that 90, if not 100% of, okay, let me just say 80% of the world, because you have another, maybe 20% of it that have some religious goal to fulfill before, in order to reach a peace deal or some sort. But the thing is, the reason why I just decided to educate myself on telling the difference between a Jew and an Israeli is because propaganda is central to any conflict. And believe it or not, and this is something that I just learned just after reading on the history of Namibia and the history of apartheid. Every government that is an occupying force, believe me, lies to its people more than it lies to anyone else. And anyone that stands up, even, if someone take, for example, stands up in Israel today and reveal some of the atrocities being committed by the Israeli Defense Forces, they'll be ostracized. Now, why am I pointing that out? Because it happened last year. Last year in October,
An Israeli military top lawyer has resigned. This is from last year. BBC has resigned after saying that she was responsible for the leak of a video that reportedly shows soldiers, these are Israel Defense Force soldiers, sexually abusing a Palestinian detainee in 2024.
Mm.
Now, this is a lawyer within the Israeli military that leaked a video of a sexual assault. Now, sexual assault is one thing, but sexual assault and filming it, like, what is the goal? So you can imagine now this, you know, she was just, I don't know what the motivation behind her going public with this, and she lost her job in the process. Mm. Now,
Was she Israeli?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember now. It was an Israeli person. It was an Israeli army officer.
Yeah,
Was the person police?
The military advocate general.
Oh yes. She was the legal counsel for the Israeli army.
Yeah.
When she saw the evidence.
Now, how am I supposed to defend you when you are doing something that is that brings your entire morality into question? So she leaked the whole thing.
Mm.
Now that is against client attorney privileges and confidentiality. She knows that. She's a lawyer. But she just went against it because you have got to be sick to sexually assault someone, let alone make an entire video of it.
I'm not gonna ask you. Oh. Do you know how they did that?
Okay, my turn.
Hold on. Just let me finish my story. As I was saying, my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm.
Just give it more eyes. Anyways, long story short.
Oh, hi. When you're talking, it's a short story long.
Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back. Now, that story, you know, the good thing is that story just came out of, you know, the Israeli state itself. Came out of the Israeli state itself. Now, hang on a second. When was this? Just yesterday, Euronews put out the following article. Euronews put out this article that Israel freezes out a United Nations chief Antonio Guterres over inclusive on sexual violence list. Just a brief of that. Mm. Now, the United Nations cited credible information regarding sexual violence allegedly committed by Israeli security forces against Palestinians in prisons and other detention centers. Israel is breaking all contact with the United Nations, according to the article. The United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres, the country's ambassador announced on Thursday, that's yesterday, saying it was outrageous. Israel is being blacklisted over alleged sexual violence in conflict zones. Here's the thing. You have a lawyer that had to resign because of sexual violence video.
From your own army.
From your own army. And you are saying it's outrageous. And then he went on, and this was on Twitter, by the way, or X. Then the ambassador now went on to say that, we are done with this secretary general. We are done with this secretary general. Now, the decision to blacklist Israel and accuse us of using sexual violence as a weapon of war is an outrageous decision. This said the ambassador, still going on. He said, referring to the upcoming report from Guterres' office. Now, the secretary general's team continues to spread lies against Israel. It's not lies if your lawyer had to resign after revealing the evidence. This is the thing about the Israeli government and its soldiers. The Israeli government is trying a lot to sort of like save global face by investing a lot of money in PR, but soldiers keep making videos of themselves doing exactly what their government is saying their soldiers are not doing. And they put it all over social media. And the Louis Terro guy made a documentary on the people themselves on the ground, and they did not help themselves.
Did you know, Helmut, there was a report that was submitted to the British police
by an NGO who was tracking British nationals, or who are obviously Jewish community, from the Jewish community in England, British nationals who serve, who actively were serving in the Israeli army during the 7 October conflict up until now.
Oh, Israel, yeah, I mean, Australia is doing exactly that right now.
Now, they submitted a report, this NGO submitted a report to the British police last year. The British police has refused to prosecute these people because there is an active piece of legislation of British nationals who go and fight for other countries in conflicts.
Uh-huh.
Come back. Now, it's something that stemmed literally from the ISIS conflict, the Syria conflict specific, to be specific, wherein there were a lot of people from Europe, young people, who wanted to go to go and experience warfare, and they literally left.
Experience warfare?
Yes. Young women to become the brides in action for these fighters for ISIS. That's how the radicalization was happened.
Okay.
And the young men to be literally the fighters on the ground. That led us to the very famous, I'll use the name, denationalization of, what's that woman's name? The woman who, she's a British national. She was born, her parents are like second generation or first generation immigrants to England, Pakistani immigrants. She was born and raised in England. Her parents were naturalized Brits. And because she was one of those young people who responded in 2011, 2013, or 2014 by going to Syria to join ISIS, she is literally in limbo because she was stripped of citizenship. You heard of the police, the British police officer who was recently, the former British police officer who was formerly who was recently stripped of his British nationalism. A British citizenship. But here's the thing, Amut. How can you be stripped of your citizenship? Nah.
Yeah.
If your citizenship is based upon where you are born.
Like a prosecution, maybe, but stripping citizenship.
Now, the British have this weird thing. Stripping you of citizenship if you participated in any acts against the government, which would be perceived as an act against the government.
Yeah. You know, all this, you know, if you just look at the conflict itself, not just on the disagreement between the, between the leaders themselves, but also on a lot of differences in point of view on pretty much everything, social behavior to religion and all those things on the people on the ground in all these different countries. You have it sort of helps to draw a very gloomy picture about the ending of this conflict. Because, I'm just looking at what's going on, in response to the UN. I mean, the Israeli government, from the look of things here, judging by their ambassador's, words, because the ambassador here is representing his country. They don't agree with the UN's, addition of the Israeli forces to that. It's sort of like it's a blacklisting of sort. And this is a list where you find guys like ISIS.
Mm.
Yeah. And which is a very, terrible classification. You'd actually understand, the Israeli ambassador's response to that. But here's the thing. The investigations being made, who is doing the investigation? And the thing is, the Israeli government can deny a lot of, a lot of these things.
Yeah.
But again, for the millionth time, the soldiers keeps making videos about them. And it's not helping the morale, or more like the point of view of the people on the ground. And the sad thing is, a lot of people now around the world are taking that point of view and thinking every Jew, irrespective of where they find themselves, that's how they think. Those ones that were interviewed in Louis Terror's documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, but that seems, from the look of things, to be a very Israeli thing.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, even within Israel, you have some kind of, you know, you have anti-war movements going on within Israel. And I didn't actually know that. I didn't know that there were, you know, any anti-war movement going on within Israel until I started reading Haaretz, which is like you know, Israel's version of New Era.
Yeah.
So until you basically, because I think that's where I started. The first question I kept asking myself is, why can't I find this in in like BBC or CNN? It turns out for some reason they don't cover much of that. But for all the anti-war movement,
oh, they've been taken to parliamentary inquiries in the UK regarding the coverage. There's this thing that the BBC has its own bias, a supposed standard on bias, and they quickly had to flip around because it was also discovered that so many of the higher up, the hierarchy of the BBC itself.
Yeah.
Are people that work, that have particular ties to certain Zionist lobbies in the UK.
Oh.
That's why I use the word Zionist lobbies. And this has been also been outed by various politicians from other political parties regarding, you know, the supposed neutrality that the BBC has to play in disseminating information since its earliest foundations way back.
Yeah.
Before the First World War, literally after the First World War. I mean, how old is the BBC World Service? I mean, my mom them told me they could hear that thing from here. Literally.
Jeez.
Literally. 100. Oh, my goodness. 103 years old, 1922.
1922.
Okay, so if you guys also don't know, dear listeners, countries in the Northern Hemisphere. As much as they want to tell our global South governments to cut down on government spending, né, and the role of a government, they have, for example, Germany has 14 government-funded TV stations. Different entities.
Mm-hmm.
14 of them.
Okay,
so the one that doesn't transmit in Germany,
yeah,
Deutsche Welle, is for the world outside.
So it's for you and me. We have 5 minutes left to the hour of six. You're still listening to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. But before we continue, let's take a live read. The Vichia University 2026 July applications are now open. Faculty of Health Sciences, a postgraduate diploma in community health nursing, level 8. Admission requirements: have a recognized nursing qualification at NQF level 7 or higher from any recognized higher learning institution. Must be a registered nurse/midwife with a Nursing Council of Namibia HPCNA. Must have a minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse/midwife in any health facility. Must write a short essay describing the motivation of pursuing postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. Qualification duration, 1 year. Mode of delivery, full time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406. Vilvicha University, where everyone is an achiever. So, now, the thing is, this conflict has a lot of question marks that are more they have a lot of misalignments. The conflict itself, especially, you can look at it from the leadership or the people on the ground in terms of social cohesion. There is a lot of misalignments to the point where you can't help but think, oh my God, this thing is gonna drag on for a while. And that translates into, oh my God, I'm gonna be broke for a while.
Well, it's not just the brokenness, Helmut. It's also a question of if our listeners now had to ask us, okay, so Dwight and Helmut, what is your verdict about this conflict with Iran ending anytime soon?
All I know is I feel pity for the president. Basically, this administration.
I also feel pity for them.
Yeah.
Because in July last year, 2025, when NDP6 was being launched, there was a lot of fanfare. I even felt the positivity in July last year. I wanted for the first time in my life
to make real change here.
To be a cheerleader. And then we come to 3 January and I'm like,
oh, boy.
No. What's going on here? Why? What did Maduro do? And then, okay, maybe we can live without Venezuela for now.
Yeah.
And then 28 February happens. I mean, Hamoud, we said one thing, literally, Minister Shafuda's speech the Thursday, 26 February, was about, things.
We are projecting this growth.
We might go here, we might go there, and we are envisaging this kind of expenditure. Friday comes through, you and I, we do the home run. I'm still, okay, wow,
Wonderful weekend.
How can I enjoy my Saturday? And then I literally wake up with my sister telling me, Dwight, Donald Trump is delivering democracy to Iran. I'm like, oh my goodness.
This is bad.
Not bad because of the fighting. Oh my goodness. Bad for the rest of us who are not fighting.
Yep.
Fuel immediately. The first thing I thought about was fuel.
Yeah.
And that's why I listen always to neutral academics, neutral economists who are academics at universities who will tell you there was a trivialization by economists, other economists in the rest of the global economy who would say fuel is fuel, oil is oil. If it's black oil.
Okay, my turn. Hold on. Just let me finish my story. As I was saying,
my man, you've been finishing your story for 10 minutes now. Even my chassis is getting warm.
Just keep my eyes. Anyways, long story short.
Oh, hi. When you're talking, it's a short story long.
Short stories turn long. Go best together with Tassenberg. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back.
There was so the point I was just going to make before the break was there was this sort of like trivialization of the different kinds of petroleum you find in the world.
Yeah,
where apparently, and this is I'm literally referencing Steve Keen, who was on the Diary of a CEO podcast with that Stephen guy. He clearly wanted to guide the conversation for Steve Keen, and Keen was willing. Helmut, if you ever watch that particular episode of Diary of a CEO, personally I don't watch it because I can't stand the guy whose thing it is, because he only talks to people specifically that he feels safe in. But anyway, the subject matter that Steve Keen highlighted there was regarding the conflict with Iran was that he literally said his own country, Australia, at the time of the conflict with Iran from 28 February heading into March, is that his country, Australia, literally had 2 weeks of national fuel stock. Strategic reserves,
yeah.
National fuel stock left or available. Now he said, it's not about your car not moving.
Mm.
It's a country like Australia who is highly dependent upon its agricultural sector for food in your shops. He said, countries like Australia and India that imports a lot of fertilizer that comes from the petroleum chemical sector of the Middle East.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why the Power to X wishes to also replace the dependency of the petrochemical sector
in terms of
the global fertilizer trade. Is that the petrochemical sector has been a boon, has been a literal lucky charm for the global agricultural sector. And the discussion from that has been is that it seems like people were trivializing that oil is oil. If it's black over here, it's definitely black over there.
Except it's not.
Until Steve Keen explained, if you go talk to the geologists who know about oil, they will tell you the oil in Venezuela is literally like a goo.
So,
it's like a jelly.
So
and
in
it's
other
mostly
words,
used for lubrication.
So in other words, when you're building a refinery, almost if not every refinery is built to refine a specific type of crude oil.
Yeah. The oil in Angola is different than the oil from Venezuela.
So
the oil in Iran is like a water.
It's not a one size fits all.
Definitely not.
Yeah, so you heard that? So it's, you know, it's oil, not condom, so it's going to be different. Speaking of which, have a good Friday. That brings us to the end of...
I don't know where that came from, but yeah. Let's see each other again on Sunday specifically, guys. For my Sunday morning take, alternatively, Helmut and I will be back on Monday. Yeah. David is here bouncing a ball, trying to, for some reason, intimidate us with his cricketing skills, or I think it's his tennis skills.
All right.
But we'll see each other again, guys, and stay tuned for business and economic segment with David. Yeah.